I haven't used before, but it looks to me like it is indeed recording.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me just put this right here, and that should be fine. Okay, folks. We're going to talk about Aristotle today as a prelude to Epicurus. I'm going to make this segue into Epicurus. I began talking about Aristotle last time. I think Aristotle is key because he is the philosopher in whom the classical tradition of early Western moral philosophy receives its culminating and consummate expression. In other words, Socrates begins by raising the moral questions: what is justice, what is moderation, what is courage, what is wisdom, and so forth. Plato attempts answers, and he gives brilliant answers, but they're answers that are hardly serviceable when it comes to the problem that people actually face. And the problem that people actually face is, how should I act in a given situation? Now, Plato develops a very sublime theory of ethical values and virtues as parts of the intelligible structure of the cosmos. But when it comes to answering the question, what should I do in this particular situation, he's not very good. Aristotle notices this. Hold on. Aristotle notices this, and he begins his lectures on ethics, his Nicomachean ethics, by saying that an ethics that is simply geared toward knowing what the good is not sufficient. What we need is an ethics that can tell us what the good is in particular circumstances requiring action.
Yeah, are a lot of Aristotle's ideas based around societal ideas we were throwing around for a while, or these new concepts that were just coming around?
Aristotle is a product of his society, as is Socrates, as is Plato. He is a product of the Athenian polis. You cannot imagine him having existed outside of that polis. Having said that, it's also true that Aristotle was one of the most creative minds that the world has ever produced. So what you find in him is a rootedness in his culture, but an attempt to creatively transform what he finds there into something that can be grasped by thought. And in that sense, he's a great innovator. He's both conservative in a sense, he has his roots in the society, and he's also revolutionary in the sense that he's developing a new way of looking at the social practices that the Athenians have and so on. And remember, what Aristotle tells us is that everything has a good unique to it. Everything has a good unique to the kind of thing that it is. Different kinds of things have different goods that are unique to them. So that, for example, the good of a plant is to be able to metabolize nutrients, to grow, and to reproduce well. The act of metabolizing nutrients, of growing, and of reproduction are functions that the plant engages in. And by functions, all I mean is activities that are essential to being a plant. To perform those activities well is for the plant to realize its natural good. And Aristotle says that the natural good of the plant is the end or the goal state that the plant seeks, even if it is not conscious. You don't need to be conscious to have a goal state here. An animal, remember, engages in nutrition, in growth and reproduction, but it has functions that are unique to it, namely motion and perception. To realize its good, an animal, a non-human animal, must be able to move and to perceive well. Now, to move well, to move quickly, and to be able to perceive well, to be able to notice changing circumstances, and to react to them quickly, is the good of an animal being. If an animal doesn't realize that good, it gets eaten, right? Or it gets trapped by rocks, or it's unable to move, it's unable to sense its environment, it's unable to gather the information it needs to continue its life process, and of course it perishes. So the natural good of an animal is to perform its functions of perception and sensation well. And of course, this assumes that its plant-like character is functioning well too, right? It's bringing in, taking in nutrients, it's growing, and it's reproduction. Human beings are animals. Remember, Aristotle called them zoon logikon. Zoon means that they belong to the class of animals. We move. We perceive the world the way animals do. We also have a plant-like layer to us. We take in nutrients, we grow, we reproduce. But we have functions that are unique to us. And those are the functions that Aristotle sums up with the word logikon. Logikon means the animals who use the logos, L-O-G-O-S in Romanized spelling. And the logos is the capacity to exercise thought, or the capacity to exercise reason. What distinguishes human beings from other kinds of animal beings is our status as thinking beings. Now, for Aristotle, there are different kinds of thought. There are different kinds of rationality. There is theoretical rationality and practical rationality. If you begin with practical rationality, you know, there are two kinds according to Aristotle. There is technical rationality, and that is the kind of rationality that a carpenter needs, a plumber needs, a computer specialist needs, a doctor needs. By the way, in the Greek world, doctors were classed with other craftsmen because they do something very similar to other craftsmen. They use their hands and other devices in order to intervene in the condition of the patient, the way a craftsman uses his hands and other devices to intervene in the condition of a piece of wood.
Did Aristotle define how humans can realize their good?
Yes.
It's very complex, it seems, at this point.
He's going to. That's, in fact, what the Nicomachean Ethics is all about. And so what he says is that there's technical rationality. There is moral rationality. Moral rationality is our ability to see what ought to be done in a circumstance calling for action, where action is judged by the notions of good and bad. Yes? Were you going to say something? I'm sorry. And then there is theoretical rationality, and theoretical rationality grows from the very basic curiosity of children all the way up to the obsession of the, for example, of the physicist to understand the structure of the cosmos. Nothing's going to flow from that, at least not for a theoretical physicist. You know, the theoretical physicist doesn't want to invent something or to patent it or to enable us to, I don't know, make quicker phone calls or more of them or whatever, right? A theoretical physicist just wants to understand the structure of things. You know, the laws that govern the natural world, the equations that they can be expressed in and so forth. That's simply a highly developed form of the curiosity of children. And the same thing is true about the curiosity of the knowing activity of the mathematician, of the philosopher, even of the musician, because remember, for the Greeks, music is a branch of mathematics. And what the musician is doing is he or she is mapping out the relationship between pitches and large-scale harmonic structures. This is something that's very similar to what mathematicians do, except that mathematicians don't limit themselves to notes, to sounds. These are all forms of theoretical rationality. Now you begin, how do you do this, right? How do you realize the good that is appropriate to human beings? Well, the good is the full flourishing of human rational capacities, technical, moral, and theoretical. The full flourishing of human technical, moral, and theoretical rational capacities. To do that, to have those capacities flourish fully, is to realize the end that is natural to human beings. But how do you do that? You begin with, let's see here. I'm terrible at drawing. This looks like a Halloween pumpkin, but this will give you an example of why I'm going to say what I'm going to say. This is actually a human infant. A human infant, right?
Human what?
A human infant. You ever meet one of those?
No, not lately.
Yeah, human infants are the most disgusting creatures on the planet. You know, they should all be shot, and we should dig a mass grave and shovel all them in. And this is why. Human infants are completely self-centered. They don't give a damn about you. I don't care if you're mommy or daddy or the little sister or somebody they just bumped into in the street. The only way that you function in their universe is with respect to your capacity to meet their needs. If you meet an adult that operates like that, you think that they are disgusting creatures. They belong either in prisons or in mental institutions.
So you mean infants? You define that somebody who's self-centered. Is it
that? Say it again.
Can you give me like an example? Like,
an example?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll give you an example, and I'll give you this little kid. What am I thinking of? Like 1 year old, two years old, right? 2 years old is especially good because they're ambulatory then and getting into everything and really causing havoc. Little Johnny picks up a pen. He finds a pen when he's not with his mother. And there's his little sister sitting there who happens to be 1 year old instead of two. And he sticks the pen into the little sister, and the little sister reacts with pain. Isn't that hilarious? Let's do that again. Let's see that reaction again, right? Sticks the pen again, the little sister reacts with pain. Now, what's going on there? The infant is not a sadist, right? A sadist is somebody who knows that the little girl is going to experience pain when he sticks the pin in her because he knows that the little girl has experiences, period. 2-year-old Johnny doesn't even know that his little sister has any experiences at all. He is the sole center of the universe. The sister is just this little bundle of flesh that makes funny faces when you stick it with a pin. Piaget, who is a developmental psychologist, who wrote in the first half of the 20th century and had a huge impact on developmental psychology, wrote a book called The Moral Development of the Child. And it's quite clear from Piaget's studies, and it's been confirmed ever since, that infants do not begin with a morality. And the reason why they don't is that they don't begin with the recognition that there is anybody in the universe besides them. And by anybody in the universe, what I mean is anybody in the universe capable of having experiences, feelings, needs, internal states of any kind. It's a developmental achievement for infants to achieve that recognition, for children, young children, to achieve that recognition. And by the way, there's some children who don't. You know, and those are the people who, when they become older, we call sociopaths. Yes?
I have an 18-month-old, and about like 2-3 months ago, yeah. She used to look in the mirror and thought it was another baby, and mm-hmm. So she would, you know, try to talk to it and everything, but now she's like, starting to realize, you know, different babies, and she actually...
That's
I don't
great.
Know why she acts like this, but when she sees babies in public, they'll like try to play with her, say hi to her. She'll just like look away like she's...
Well, she'll learn, presumably, right?
But it kind of illustrates your...
Absolutely, and it's amazing that you talk about the mirror, because there's a French psychoanalyst, Jacques Lacan, who wrote famously about what he called the mirror stage. The mirror stage is when children begin to, through regarding their reflection in mirrors, but also regarding the way that they cause reactions in other people's faces and so forth, they begin to distinguish between themselves as something that has an observable outside, somebody who has an observable outside, and the other person who can observe them, but who is different from them. So the mirror phase is absolutely essential to achieving that kind of the capacity to understand that there are other experiencers in the world. Yeah?
Well, what about with children that have, for example, feral children who are growing up on their own entire lives?
Yeah. What about them? There are cases of feral children. And generally, feral children are not children who've grown up on their own, because no child can grow up on its own.
Well,
they perish, right?
Yeah.
But how do they grow up?
Well, I've heard of a case in India where a child was raised in the forest and apparently animals.
Yeah. Yeah, there are cases in Europe, too, of children raised by wolf packs. They're very famous cases. There's a case of the wolf boy, but this is not the werewolf, right? Although I want to see that new movie, by the way. but it's a case of a child who was abandoned in the woods somehow and is raised by a pack of social animals. The canines are social animals. So the canines raise the boy as though he were a member of the pack. And so, but what happens when the feral child is discovered at the age of 16 or 17?
Well, they're not socialized.
They're wolves. For all intents and purposes, right?
Would they be able to speak?
They can be taught to speak, although it's tough. But they can be taught to speak because the human capacity to generate language is hardwired into the brain. It's best developed, as we all know, in early childhood, right? Children can absorb languages like sponges. You know, whereas if you and I try to acquire a language now, it's like pulling teeth, right? But you can get a feral child to speak. But the problem is that, you're absolutely right, they're not socialized. Or a better way to put it is to say they're socialized into a wolf pack, right? They're socialized into a wolf pack. Do you know who Stephen Gould is? Stephen Gould is an evolutionary biologist who was a pathbreaking scientist, taught at Harvard for years, and then died about 3 years ago. And Gould had a talent that many academics don't have. He could write brilliantly for a general audience. And he wrote short articles that were published in magazines all over the country, in many cases all over the world, about evolutionary biology. And the articles are fantastic. He collected them in compendiums. One is called The Panda's Thumb. There are several, actually. I'm blanking on the other ones. But in addition to doing path-breaking theoretical work, he also had this kind of writing career for the general public. And he wrote a piece that I love, and the piece is about Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse, of course, is the Disney character, right? And in his article on Mickey Mouse, Stephen Gould tries to show how Mickey Mouse became the way that he ultimately did become. When the Disney studios started out, when Disney started out in the Depression exploiting all kinds of out-of-work cartoonists, by the way, Disney is one of the most disgusting human beings imaginable. He put his own name on work that other people did, in essence. Now, when he began by exploiting out-of-work cartoonists, Mickey Mouse did not look the way he looks now. Mickey Mouse had a mouse-like face. And what that means is the face was rather narrow. It came to a narrow snout. The eyes were small and beady, and the ears were, you know, sort of like appropriately mouse ears, appropriately proportioned, kind of point, little pointed, and that kind of thing. And then, as the Disney studio did their audience testing thing, right, where they try to refine what's going to appeal to people, the Mickey Mouse face began to change gradually, and what happened is the face became rounder, the snout was pushed in, the eyes became big and round, and the ears became large. Now, what Gould points out is that Mickey Mouse began to exhibit the proportions that characterize the face of a human infant. Big eyes, round head, small nose, that kind of thing. And why? Well, what he says is, what he speculates is, that when we see an infant, we go, "Ah, oh, isn't she adorable? Isn't she cute?" And we start making goo-goo, gaga, gurgling sounds and making asses of ourselves and so forth as we melt in this kind of general feeling of protective amusement, I guess you could call it, right? What Gould says is that if you look at this as an evolutionary biologist, that reaction has been programmed into us by the evolutionary process. And the reason why it's been programmed into us is that if we did not exhibit it, we would have killed our infants a long time ago, and the species would have died out. So, as a matter of evolutionary survival, we acquired the instinct of reacting to the facial proportions of an infant with, isn't she cute, rather than, isn't that a real psychopath out there? Yeah. Were you going to say something? Yeah.
With regards to Mother East, Goo Goo Gaga, not everybody actually does that. My parents were strictly opposed to it. They thought it was denigrating. They didn't use it.
Well, that explains a lot. I've known you now for almost a year. They thought it was denigrating. What do they do with it? What do they read to you from the New York Times when you were a year old?
Oh, not quite. My mom started reading me Tolkien when I was about 4 or 5. And
but what about when you were, you know, 0 to 3?
Well, they always said that they never talked to me that way. Based on my observations of how they raised my sister, they didn't talk that way to her.
So they just talk, what, they talk rationally to a
one-year-old? Yeah, they talk like you're a little person, even though you have no understanding.
Gee, you know, the stock market collapsed yesterday. Where do you think I should put my money?
Well, not, you know, complex questions like that, but no, like, Mother East, no goo goo gaga or baby talk.
I'm still trying to figure out what the hell they said to you when you were 1 year old.
Well, I think my dad swore a lot.
Well, that's par for the course, yeah.
Well, what happens when the facial proportions are different? Do you have a reaction of disgust or anger against a child?
Did you ever see, that episode of Seinfeld where their friend has a young child? And they're begging, you know, Seinfeld and Lane and Kramer to come see the little baby. You got to see the baby, okay? So they go to see the baby, and the baby is ugly as sin. So they're all, they have an immediate reaction of revulsion. But then they got to tell the mother, yeah, the baby really is beautiful. Yeah.
I actually wondered this myself. My daughter is beautiful, but like, you know, like you said, you know, if you have an ugly baby, like, and it's your child, do you, like, would you see that it's not a good-looking child? Would you be able to see that? Or because you had that child, would it be, like, kind of...
Yeah. I think the answer is it depends on the parent, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, some parents are so in love with their children that they'll see beauty no matter what.
Some people hate their children so much they can't hate them no matter what.
Yeah, well, that's true too.
They can still judge, like, the physical appearance.
And also, it's also true that standards of beauty differ, you know, certainly from culture to culture, although not as much as you would think. Mm-hmm. You know, still symmetry in the placement of the eyes and its relation to the nose and the mouth and so forth. But, for example, the size of the ears is variable among cultures. I mean, some cultures, some African cultures try to stretch the ears out because they see that as a symbol of feminine beauty. So there are differences and there are ways to adapt, and like the mother in Seinfeld, there are ways to convince yourself that your ugly kid really is beautiful. only you can't convince your friends. That's the problem.
This is just a weird anecdote, but I read somewhere that there was some speculation as to how that the ear thing came about, and that it might have actually developed as a way to deter slavers on the grounds that they wouldn't make.
Sure, it's possible, but it quickly became incorporated into the cosmetic routine of some African women. So that, in other words, it became a mark of beauty, a symbol of beauty, and was developed in that fashion, whatever its origins were. But listen, the point is that how do you get from this, very, very cute kid, psychopath, right? Sociopath. How do you get from a sociopath to a person who is capable of living a human life in relation to other people, taking into account questions of moral propriety, taking into account the needs and the interests of other people, and so forth? How do you do that? There has got to be a process of development, right? We don't begin that way. We want to develop from this into this person. This is an adult human being capable of taking his or her place in a community. How do you do that? Well, the process of moving from this to this, in other words, the process of moving from human nature as it originally is to human nature as it could be, were people to achieve their natural end. Okay? I'll say it again. The process of moving from human nature as it begins, as it starts out, to human nature as it could be, were people to achieve their natural end, to realize the good that is appropriate to them as people, is the process, Aristotle says, of acquiring the virtues.
It's the virtues that enable us to make the transition from this to this. Now, what are the virtues? In the Greek tradition, there are four main virtues, four cardinal virtues. They are wisdom, courage, moderation, and justice. Without these, it's not possible to live a fully developed life among other people. In other words, without these, it's not possible for one's specifically human capacities to flourish. Without these, it's not possible to make the transition from human nature as it is in the beginning to human nature as it could be for people to realize their natural end.
Did the Greeks have a different definition of wisdom, courage, moderation, justice, or is it basically a similar idea to what we
think? Oh, the question of definition is the central philosophical question. It's the question that Socrates raises. What is justice? And nobody can answer, right? And then it's the question that Plato attempts to answer, and then it's the question that Aristotle attempts to answer. This is the chief topic of moral philosophy. So whatever the Greeks believe, the question really is, what do the Greek philosophers have to say about it? And that's what we're beginning to look at, right? Okay, but rather than start with wisdom, let's take justice. Oh, by the way, virtues, the Greek word for virtues is arete. Actually, for virtue is arete. That's the singular. And arete means excellence. Excellence of functioning. So that, for example, you got a wristwatch? Yeah, the arete of this wristwatch is to keep good time. Right? A wristwatch that doesn't keep good time doesn't perform its function well. But a wristwatch that keeps good time has the virtue of performing its function well. What's the function of a knife?
To cut.
What's the virtue of a knife?
To be sharp.
Sharpness. The function of the knife is to cut. The virtue of the knife is the excellence that allows the knife to perform its function well, namely sharpness. People have functions, right? These are rational functions, functions that are unique to them. The virtues are what allow them to exercise their function as well. But with excellence. Well, let's take a look at the virtue of justice here, because I think you can clearly see what's at issue with the moral virtues anyway. Wisdom is really a theoretical virtue. It's a virtue about the kind of knowledge that we have. But the other virtues are virtues that bear on questions of how to act in particular situations where we're trying to achieve the good. Take justice, okay? Your mother sends you to the... and you hear the... I mean, you still have these ice cream trucks that come around in the suburbs, right? Yeah. So when the ice cream trucks come around in the suburbs, do they come around to the city too? Probably not, because they're like you can get ice cream all over the place, right? Do they come around the city?
Yeah.
They do come around the city. All right. You got the trucks that kind of... I know I lived in cities my whole life, but I never remember ice cream trucks coming around. But in any event, you hear the ice cream truck coming around, right? And so you say to your mother, you know, I want ice cream, right? You know, having one foot in the world of the disgusting infant that has nothing but needs that must be met. And so your mother says, all right, here is whatever the ice cream costs now. Here is $45. Get one for yourself and one for your sister. Right? So you take the $45, you go down to the ice cream truck, you buy one for yourself and one for your sister, but on the way back, you eat both of them. Right, you eat both of them. Now, what does your mother say to you when you get back?
Change.
Say it again? Where's my change? Very good. All right, that might be the first thing she said. What's the second thing she says?
Where's the other ice cream?
Where's the other ice cream? And you say, I ate it, and then what? What does she say?
You're grounded. You're in trouble.
Why? Why?
It's the justice for the act you did. It's punishment.
But why? Why is it just to punish a child for doing that?
So they don't do it again.
But why shouldn't they do it again?
It's just wrong.
You see, this is the problem. You're thinking like parents. Parents never give any good answers to these questions, right? Do as I say, not as I do, right? I'm telling you to do it, do it. That is as far from moral philosophy as you can get. Why should I do it? Besides the fact that you're going to smack me if I don't.
Well, obviously your sister has subjective human experiences too, and as a parent you can't just say, look into your sister and like see that she's a human being. You have to, you know, sometimes you have to be harsh and firm and say, if you can't acknowledge that your sister has needs and feelings too, then you have to go sit in the corner for 5 minutes.
But who cares whether your sister has needs and feelings? I mean, does that really bear on the question of justice?
I think so.
Would it ever be just to deny your sister, for your sister to be denied an ice cream cone? Under what conditions? Yes?
If she did something bad.
Ah, okay. Yeah. All right, well, I mean, but then I can always ask you what's bad. But let's say that we know that, for example, what? Sticking the pin in the sibling was bad, right? So the sister did that, and now she's being punished. And see, under those conditions, it's just to have one child, the child who did not stick the pins, receive an ice cream cone, but not both. But what the mother is saying to the kid, if she can articulate it, and many parents can't, is that there is nothing to distinguish you and your sister in this case. In other words, your sister is not being punished. There's no morally relevant distinction between you and your sister when it comes to receiving an ice cream cone. So taking both of them and denying her one is an injustice against her. Parents would more likely say it's unfair to her.
But that relies on her not being bad, not anyone being...
It relies on the parents not punishing her at that point, making that judgment, yes.
What about the fact he didn't follow her directions?
He didn't follow the mother's directions?
Yeah, she told him to get one from himself and his sister.
See,
he didn't do that.
This is a tough one with parents, you know, because in a way, the argument, I told you to do it, in a way, it's sometimes appropriate, right? It's appropriate when the parent knows the good of the child and the child does not. So the notion here, see, it's not just authority. If all you're interested in is having your kid doubt your authority, then the hell with you. You know, that's just sheer authoritarianism. But if you're interested in having your kid do what you tell them because what you're telling them to do is in their best interest, that's another story. And children are not always in a position to understand what's in their best interest. So in those situations, saying to the kid, do it because I say it, doesn't mean do it because I'm bigger than you and I can kick the living crap at it. Right? It means do it because I know best, you don't know yet. You will at some point.
Well, I have experience.
But not now. Yeah, exactly. Don't touch the stove.
Don't feel.
Why not? Shh. Don't touch the stove. Why not? You know, because I know it hurts. You know, you don't know it yet, but I know it. Right? Yes, please.
Well, I was going back to with the ice cream. Well, it's injustice because you would treat others the way you want to be treated.
No? Yeah, the way you would want to be treated, but also in accordance with some kind of standard of fairness. Standard of fairness. You see, I might want to be treated in such a way that no matter what I do, no matter how terrible I am to other people, I still get rewarded. But that's not justice. Right? It's not even justice to say that you should be able to treat other people terribly and get rewarded.
I was thinking of the good part.
But you're right. But you are right.
Yeah, but you're right too, because somebody might get off on.
Yeah, I mean, think about it, you know, honor among thieves, right? You know, we all like one another because we're equally good at screwing other people over. Right. Yeah.
But I think part of it finds the difference between what you're saying with a toddler and what it means to be a person. For example, your sister might be just as hungry and just as wanting of the ice cream as you are, and then to deny that is you have to look beyond yourself and look as what it would be like for as if your sister did the same thing to you.
It's true, and there is an element of that built into justice. In other words, part of the idea of justice is you don't, and we'll talk about this when we talk about Kant later on, you don't make a special exception in your own case. You know, we're always making special exceptions in our case. You know, I really like that pen. You know, in general, I think stealing is terrible, but I really like that pen. So when you're not looking, I'm going to take it. All right? And after all, your need for the pen couldn't possibly be as important as my need for the pen. Right? I mean, it's kind of nice, but you're not me. You see, that's the attitude that makes an exception in our own case. And that leads to placing our needs and interests above the needs and interests of others, and that abrogates the virtue of justice.
From humans and animals to a point.
To an extent, yeah. Yes, yes.
Could you recap your position on this, sir?
Say it again?
Could you recap your position?
Yes, my position is this, and it's not my position, it's Aristotle's position, is that you begin with the inchoate needs and desires and selfishness of the infant.
No, just specifically the ice cream cone, because we've heard a couple different arguments. We've heard, I think, our arguments, sir, are roughly on the somewhat equivalent in dealing with subjectivity. You had...
Okay, I'll tell you what my argument is, and this is Aristotle's argument, too. When you first begin inquiring what justice is, you don't know what the subjectivity is, you don't know any of this fancy shit that, you, like, you know, that you're introducing into a philosophy class. All you know is that you have to act in a certain way. You generally screw up. A parent or a, you know, in an older age, a military trainer, a athletic trainer, a teacher, an older friend who's been through the situation says to you, you know what? That's wrong. You know what? Keeping the both ice cream cones is wrong. And begin to change your behavior in relation to that judgment. Now, that only works if there is a broad social consensus about the way in which you should change your behavior. Let me give you another example. No, listen. Let me give you another example, okay? You go out for football in high school, and you know, you're sort of, you know, big and hefty, so you go out for tackle, you know, so you're a linesman, and your job is to prevent. You're playing defensively. Your job is to prevent the other guy from crossing the line and teaming your quarterback, right? Okay, so you're at the line of scrimmage, and you get down in your crouch, and the other guy's like got like 50 pounds on you. And he's got more muscle, but more body development. So what happens? You get down in the crouch, and the ball is hiked, and you move aside, and the other linesman goes through and clobbers the quarterback. And your teammates say to you, that was cowardly. That was cowardly. And you begin to recognize that, yes, that was cowardly. You know, I might have been able to prevent the quarterback from being creamed if I had exercised a little more courage on the line of scrimmage. What I'm saying here is that when you acquire the virtues, you're not in the position to reason it all out. You're much more like in the position of the infant who, I'm sorry, of the child who's told by their mother that they've committed an injustice, or the tackle on the line of scrimmage who's told by his teammates that he's been cowardly. It's in relation to those judgments that you begin to alter your behavior in accordance with a customary norm. Later on, when you reach the true age of reason, by the way, Plato said, don't start studying philosophy until you're 30. If you try to study it until before you're 30, you'll make terrible errors. When you reach the age of 30 and you can begin philosophizing, then you can say to yourself, why is it that leaving the line of scrimmage is an act of cowardice? Why is it that not giving my second, you know, ice cream cone to my sister is an act of injustice? And then all the considerations about subjectivity, this and da da da, come in. But in a society that must take the inchoate character of the infant and turn it into a human being, the only way to do that is to enable them to acquire the virtues through a process of correction. You know, that's why if you can't take criticism, you'll never learn a damn thing. I hate to say this because it's hard to take criticism. You know, one of the great virtues of the student, by the way, and of the faculty, of the professor, is the ability to be criticized and not react to it as though, you know, there was a personal attack involved. In other words, It's the ability to be criticized and to realize that you've committed an error of some kind which can now be rectified. If you don't have that, you can't progress beyond where you already are. Yes. Actually, let me take somebody else.
Okay.
Yes, please.
So Aristotle defines justice in terms of the consequences in public opinion about what that...
He will later go on to develop a philosophical principle here. And he'll say that justice involves inequality, and that the equality has to be recognized in proportional terms. That in justice we are seeking a mean between extremes. And he develops that theory of seeking a mean between extremes for the other virtues as well. He spells it out. But at this point, it's not necessary to go into all that. I mean, that's sort of the upper level philosophical reflection on his account of the way the virtues are acquired, are actually acquired in society. See, one of the problems with our society from an Aristotelian perspective is that we don't have any consensus about the virtues. For example, should a teenage unwed mother abort her fetus? Well, ask that question in our society. And the guns come out, and people start shooting at each other, right? There's no consensus about that.
In my experience, it's the people who want those guns the most who start shooting.
There's no consensus about that. I don't like guns, but I can definitely pick one up and fire if I have to. But you know what I'm saying. I mean, there's an endemic conflict over that question in our society. And there's an endemic conflict over the question of whether it's just to execute people. You know? And there's an endemic conflict. By the way, this is why I don't like teaching. I don't like teaching capital punishment. I don't like teaching abortion because we have endemic conflicts. See, the notion was that in Athens, 250,000 people connected the Athenians thought by descent. All the Athenians were essentially a big family. You could trace their descent back to the original founders of Athens, more or less. Connected by a set of social practices, of styles of family life, of public activities like theater and Olympic games and so forth. In a society like that, there was a broad consensus on questions that we can't generate consensus about. And in that kind of a society, Aristotle says the key from moving from this to this is the acquisition of the virtues through this process of education in which you make mistakes, you're corrected by people who are recognized as understanding what the virtues are. And these are not the experts of the society. You don't have to go to a philosopher for this. You go to your teachers, your parents, your friends, and so forth. Yes.
What happens in a case when you have inequality imposed upon you? For example, my grandma told me about how her eldest brother would always get more share of the food than her and her brother. And it's basically it's a social norm where the oldest and the favorite gets more food and more love than the other two. Would that be considered sociopathic behavior in our society?
I'm not really aware of any society where it's considered acceptable to give more food to a favorite.
Uh-huh.
In general, what I'm aware of is societies which say that's an injustice. It's just that some people are unjust.
And so what happens to the sense of morality basically skewed and their definition of how to react in society as warped, or does it eventually...
Yeah, you know, people do not always successfully acquire the virtues. The fact that there's a consensus about what a virtue is and that there are processes of education for making the transition from human nature as it is at the beginning to a fully developed human nature, the fact that there's an Athenian society doesn't mean that there are no vicious people in Athenian society. There are all kinds of things that some kids simply have inordinate drives and desires for fulfillment at the expense of others. There is such a thing as sociopathy. There's such a thing as having lousy parents. You know? I mean, no society can prevent that from occurring. And that's exactly why we need the virtue of justice. We need the virtue of retributive justice, of criminal justice, of... See what I'm saying?
Yes.
I know we're talking about Aristotle like that, but it, well, he's the example, but in different cultures, people figured have different virtues. Like he was saying, I remember my grandmother, we had to wait till my uncle got there to sit down to eat. He was the oldest boy.
Yeah.
And don't touch that food.
Yeah, and I can understand that. And that's a tough one. And actually, I wouldn't say that's the same as having a favorite. You know, but what that is an attempt to sort of reinforce the special status of the uncle. Right? I don't particularly like the idea.
Yeah, but that's how it was. But she was from Barbados, that's how it was in her country.
So. And there's some, I mean, in India, I remember, I have an Indian friend, and I remember in the mid, I'm talking about Asian Indian, I remember in the mid-80s, going to a party at another, the house of another Indian. And so, and, you know, the Indians cook, I mean, their cooking is fantastic, and it's a communal effort, and there's all kinds of stuff going on in the kitchen and so forth. But the men were served first. You know, and I mentioned it, and that's the practice, right? I don't, it's changing now, gradually. But then, it was just all the men go and get their food first before the women are served. Well, you know, is that, you're talking about a tough thing here in which a customary practice is now being challenged and perhaps changing.
Yeah.
Right? And that does occur, certainly. Yeah.
My fiance works in fine dining, and now, like, you have to, like, approach from the right, and with drinks and food, you have to go to the women first and then go to the men. It's like an unspoken thing.
Right.
And if you don't do that, you know, your tips up there isn't, especially people that are used to eating in fine dining restaurants. It's kind of like uppity, it's in hangovers.
That's interesting. Yeah. But then you're talking about something very interesting. You're talking about a practice that maybe even was once customary in broader reaches of the society, but now it's not, and what it's become is the status marker now, right?
Yeah.
In other words, the people who do that are the elites. Mm-hmm. So you're not really talking about a moral norm anymore. You're talking about a way to sort of elevate yourself above the whole society. But that's an interesting example. I promise you, Epicurus next time. No more talk about Aristotle. We go directly to Epicurus. Read all three.
I'll read them all briefly.
By Epicurus. Okay, happiness, principle, doctrines, and on nature.
That's
happiness, principle, doctrines, and on nature, and we'll talk about Epicurus next week. And
what is today?
I was going to say have a good weekend, but we should probably wait until Friday, right?
We can start the weekend out. What's so funny is, what you're talking about
today?
I love
informing
you. Wait, can I talk to you? This is what my son sent me this morning. I love you, Mom, and I know he's tired.
Awesome.
But it goes, but, and that he's been very stubborn, but this is...
That's exactly what he's got. He's got enough, you obviously have enough impact on him to realize that.
Well, he's 27
that.
Now, he's married.
Yeah.
Good, but I'm like...
Oh, yeah. Was it your
partner?
No. Call him and find out. But,
I mean,
that's a guilt line.
But I'm like,
wondering about his social norms, like how can you define a social norm if they're constantly changing? Is this something that's directly inferred that obviously that you should always do?
Well, I guess the issue is this. You see, the function of the moral virtues is really to allow life in society to flourish.
Okay.
And you see, and for Aristotle, that's necessary in order for your rational capacities to flourish. If you live in a chaotic society where, you know, there are endemic conflicts and you can never get your bearings and so never any agreement about what people should do and so forth, the chances of becoming a fully developed human being on Aristotle's model become slight. Not impossible, but slight. Right? So if you live in a society that's reasonably well ordered in the sense that there's agreement about what's right and what's wrong in most cases, but there are always going to be arguments. That's in part why we have mechanisms of justice, to resolve those disputes, right? There'll always be arguments, but apart from those, it's kind of a basic consensus. Then what you have is a context where the other faculties can be developed, the faculties of rationality. But rationality is a fancy word, because when you think, you know, if you think that the carpenter, the construction worker, and so forth is also exercising rationality,
Aristotle is not just talking about, you know, science and math and so forth. He's talking about all of the mind-directed activities that make us human. That in the context of that kind of society, it becomes possible for those capacities to engage in those activities to flourish.
Okay, so it's a relatively stable society with a general consensus on social norms.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, just think about it. You know, think about our society. Well, I'll talk about this next time, but our society is quite different than ours. And the problems that people face in our society are quite different. For example, what are you going to do with your life? There was never a stage when an Athenian young adult was asked, what are you going to do with your life?
You're expected to know what you're going to do.
Well, you grow up in a situation where it becomes clear. You have choices, but you've got to arrange your choices.
In most societies, it is that way. And
yes.
It's only really in complex urban societies that people are faced with, you know, these difficult moralistic decisions about exactly. What am I going to do with my life? You know, do I rob, shoot, steal, sell heroin, you know?
Or do I go to law school?
Yeah. Do I go to law school? How do I fund going to law school?
Yeah, similar to robbing, shooting, stealing, and killing heroin.
Do I not work three jobs and try and get a fellowship?
Exactly. I mean, we face much more difficult negotiations in life.
It just gets so complex when you get past the plant stage.
It's like in sociology that they teach that only really complex, rich societies have great amounts of deviance because, you know, we have more choice
room to just...
I don't know about that. I'm not sure. The Middle Ages had plenty of deviance. It's just that they were incorporated into things like religious sect. Think about the flagellants.
Well, is it deviance, though, if it's, you know, upheld by society?
Yeah,
did you get my email about me being held by
I sent back. Did you check your email?
No, I haven't been able to get a connection.
I sent back a note saying it's fine.
Oh, great. Okay. All right. I just want to make sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hi, how you doing? I just joined the class. I wonder if there's a syllabus.
Yeah, no, there is, but I'm out now. Everything is online.
Okay.
And the syllabus is online.
Okay.
The syllabus is just the website. So, give a piece of paper and I can write it down for you so you can get to it. Did you just get
it? I got it Friday. I tried to catch you Friday doing that for this class, but I didn't.
Yeah, let me add you to it. You don't need a permission number from me? Or you
no.
Okay.
No.
And then, do you have a pen? I can get one. Yeah, let me just write it down. So what you're going to do is you're going to go to my website.
Okay.
Okay, that's www.faculty.umb.edu. And then there's a /here. And then there's my name. And my name is Gary Zabel, but it's got an underscore between the first and the second.
Okay.
So that'll bring you up to my main webpage. And then you'll click on a link that says Course Syllabi. And you'll click on the link for Phil 108. And then what will happen is you'll read through it. That's the syllabus, essentially.
Okay.
That's really the website with links to the readings. The readings are electronic.
All right, so no book to buy? Beautiful.
And yeah, no cost, except you have to give me $300.
Okay,
so Phil 108, and then you go to, you'll see that there's a link, Epicureanism. Click on that. And that'll take you to, I think there's 6 entries there. You want to read the first 3.
Mm-hmm.
Happiness, Principal Doctrines, and On Nature. And those are all by Epicurus. And the syllabus will describe what the approach of the class is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And if you have any questions, you know, just come and talk.
Okay.
You'll see my office hours and everything else, my email and stuff like that.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay. You're welcome. And what's your name?
Will Falero.
Congratulations. You got into my class.
Great. Thanks a lot. Nice to meet you.
Just say welcome. I'm glad to have you. Okay.
Okay. So just to argue when it comes to things like abortion,
yes.
I think that generally there is actually moral consensus that abortion isn't a good thing. It's how do you deal with that? Should it be permitted as, you know, the lesser of two evils?
No, I don't think there is that consensus. I think you're wrong. I think the real issue is whether abortion is bad or whether it's morally neutral.
No, I wouldn't say so. I've always felt that abortion is a bad thing, but I'm a social libertarian. And many
Well, that's true. But what I'm saying is that the argument
between the pro-life and the pro-choice sides when it becomes sophisticated is an argument about whether abortion is bad or whether it is morally neutral, so that the exercise of a woman's and privacy rights does not interfere with any other rights.
It comes down to, does a woman's right to do what she wants to with her body, is that more important than, you know, however distasteful people find abortion?
No, that's not the issue. The issue isn't whether somebody finds something distasteful. The issue is, in the way in which the argument is conducted, does the act of aborting a fetus violate rights? And you see, there the issue is, does the fetus have rights?
As a sovereign individual.
As a rights bearer, whatever that means. And so if the answer is that the fetus has no rights, that the fetus is not the kind of being that possesses rights, then the act of aborting is morally neutral.
Well,
in the same way that the act of picking up throwing a table.
Not everybody necessarily views things that way, though. I never saw things that way. I've always felt, you know, there are lots of things which I think shouldn't be illegal, which I know to be horrible social ills. And I mean, obviously, you know, as you know me, I'm greatly in favor of categorical drug reform. I wasn't always. I was actually really a teetotaler until I was about 19. And then I started seeing things that were really awful, and it completely changed my mind.
Yeah.
With regards to abortion, I had a friend who, there was this girl, he was really into her, she was really, really skanky, and she was pregnant. And she aborted her fetus with cocaine and alcohol overdoses. Mm-hmm. And it was disgusting, and you had to ask yourself if people are willing to do this just so they don't have to go into a clinic and acknowledge that they're getting an abortion.
Well, that's a much different question than the question you originally raised.
I mean, abortion has always existed. People can do it with coat hangers,
yeah,
they can do it with alcohol.
Well, they can do it with herbs.
Is it, from my perspective, and I view things generally from harm reduction perspective, it's not a question of whether a fetus is a human being or not, that I think. To me, a fetus is a human being. It is an undeveloped human being. The question is more, is it...
Is a sperm an undeveloped human being?
No.
Why not?
Because it hasn't fertilized an ova.
What difference does that make?
Well,
a fertilized egg hasn't reached the point at which there's a human being.
Well, yes, and you know, some people say that, you know, late-stage abortion is the only evil kind of abortion, and you know, a lot of people have said on that ground that, you know, lots of young fetuses just naturally go out of their mother's bodies without people even ever realizing they're pregnant. And how could it possibly be wrong to abort something you wouldn't miss? You wouldn't even have known about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly...
But then you're far from your original position, which was that everybody agrees that abortion is bad. The question is it permissible in some way?
I think most people find it, at least on some level, unpleasant to think about. I don't think people who get abortion...
Well, it's unpleasant to think about a root canal, but what is so what?
Hmm. We seem to have argued ourselves in a big circle here.
No. I actually have stayed on my position, which is that the issue is not between people who find it wrong but permissible, or bad but permissible, and people who just find it bad and impermissible. The argument is between people who find it bad and people who find it morally neutral.
Mm-hmm. I don't
Now, I'm not saying that is the actual argument that occurs in bars all across the country, but what I am saying is that when you actually look at a considered opinion, in other words, people who have reflected about it and who have joined the debate on a somewhat sophisticated level, that's where the issue is.
In different cultures, they have much, much simpler, more cardinal questions of, is it wrong, is it morally objectionable for a woman to have premarital sex, or is it morally neutral? And, you know, personally, he sort of an arc there.
See, in the Western societies where abortion has become an issue, the issue is discussed in terms of rights.
Yes.
And I think one of the reasons why is that the concept of rights is embedded in the legal codes of the countries involved, and it also has wide currency in terms of moral questions among many people in society. It's the official ideology of the society, right? That the individuals in the society possess rights, and that the state is in the job of at least providing protection from infringement and hopefully not infringing those rights itself. Right?
The Bill of Rights is the bread and circus on which our society is built.
So then the real question is, do fetuses possess rights? And then the issue is...
Is it though, or is it the language it's arguing?
Well, what I'm saying is, that's the framework in which it has been argued in. It's the legal framework which governs, for example, Roe v. Wade, which was the decision that, of course, made abortion legal in the United States, and it's the language in which even the Catholic Church argues. Right? And rights are by no means a concept that's indigenous to the Catholic Church. It's a concept of modern society, which the Church then accepts. And so the argument is in terms of rights, and so the question is the fetus a rights bearer? And if the fetus bears rights, does it bear a right to life? And so then the issue becomes one of either the fetus is a rights bearer, or let me put it another way, either the fetus bears a right to life or the fetus does not. And so the issue then becomes whether if it doesn't have a right, then what you do with it is morally neutral if it does. Now there are twists and turns on this.
But by saying that it's morally neutral, almost immediately you're giving the perspective that it's morally objectionable undue credit, I think, saying that, well, if people believe that something is morally objectionable, generally they think that if it's permitted, people are going to do it more if it's permitted on the grounds that it's morally neutral. Now, you have to ask yourself, is that necessarily a desirable outcome?
Well,
is that ammunition you want to feed them?
If something is morally neutral, then why shouldn't people do it as much as they want?
That's just it. Once you say that, almost immediately it gives ammunition to the argument that it's...
But that's a pragmatic political question and not a question of moral philosophy.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
But politics are the framework in which so much of our philosophical and cultural development is played out.
Yeah, very irrationally.
Of course.
Yeah. So, but what do we do? Do we accept the irrationality of what passes as political discourse, or do we try for a rational discourse?
Well, of course we should try for a rational discourse, but you have to frame your rational discourse in the language of politics in order to have it given credit. As you pointed out yourself, the person who just stands up and says, you're all wrong, they shout you back down. They don't care.
Yeah.
You have to make your argument in such a way that it appeals to the dissenting viewpoint.
That's it. Let me just tell you, though, there is a party to the debate that I think you would... Like, what's the name of the woman? She wrote a very famous article in which she said, grant. She didn't say fetuses have rights. She said, let's grant the strongest case that the pro-life people make, that the fetus has a right to life. I can still give you an argument that abortion is permissible. And the argument that she gave, it's vulnerable, but it's kind of interesting. The argument that she gave is, let's say that you wake up one morning and you've been tethered to a patient who needs your blood or needs some other bodily process of yours in order to live. Mm-hmm. They have a right to life. They have a right to live. Do you have the right to disconnect yourself from that tether? And their argument is, yes, you do. You have the right to disconnect yourself from that tether. Your right to live your life the way you choose supersedes, in this set of circumstances, supersedes the right of the patient to have access to your bodily substance.
Well, yes, and there, you're separating right to life from murder.
Right. And so the argument there is that we can concede that the fetus has a right to life and still recognize that the mother has a right to abort. But of course, the problem with the analogy is that it doesn't take into account a whole moral dimension that the right to life movement stresses. And that's the moral dimension of choice and responsibility. You know, you did not choose to be tethered to the patient who is depending upon your substance. But you did choose, to, presumably, unless it's a case of rape, you did choose to engage in the sexual behavior that ran the risk of pregnancy, and now you're responsible for dealing with the consequences, right? See, that her argument doesn't take into consideration that. And so there's a disanalogy between pregnancy and being tethered to someone, waking up in the morning and being tethered to someone. So that doesn't really get you where she wants to go. But it's an interesting approach. You know, you might be able to refine it in some way. So that, because what she did was, she did a typical thing, which is that concede the strongest argument of the other side, and then show that your argument is still invulnerable.
Well, that's necessary. You can't just build straw men and knock them down.
Yeah.
You know, you really have to give credit.
But you know what Roe v. Wade said? Did you ever read the text of Roe v. Wade?
Actually, I haven't.
Oh yeah, it's a very interesting document because it shows exactly what the Supreme Court does, what it does all the time, and that is under the veneer of a great deal of sophistication and argumentative ability, rational argumentative ability, it makes a decision that has nothing to do with its arguments. You know, it makes a decision based on other criteria, in particular, in this case, on an attempt to diffuse a social conflict. And so what the court ruled was that they were not in the position to judge whether the fetus has rights. And in essence, what that meant was they were not in a position to judge whether the fetus is a person. A person is a rights bearer under law. The reason why is that there was no consensus on that question among physicians, theologians, or philosophers. If there's no consensus on the question among physicians, theologians, and philosophers, then the court is not going to be able to answer that question. So, no reference will be made to the rights of the fetus, since that is an unresolved issue. Since no reference is being made to the rights of the fetus, there's only one set of rights that comes into play. Actually, there's two, but not the fetuses. There is the right of the mother to privacy, and the court asserted, it's controversial, that they asserted an implicit right to privacy in certain of the amendments of the Constitution. Privacy means control of one's own space and one's own body in this case. And they argue that the state also has a right. Actually, the state has two rights. One is the right to regulate medical procedures in the interest of the health of the patient and of all concerned. And the other is, they didn't say a right, they expressed this as an interest. An interest in the potential life of the child, not the personhood of the child, but the potential life of the child. And so on the basis of that, they came up with the trimester structure. In the first trimester, the only set of rights that's relevant is the mother's right to privacy. So the mother can abort under any circumstances. In the second trimester, medical issues come in, and the state has the right to regulate abortion, to confine it to clinics and hospitals that are licensed and that kind of thing. In the third trimester, the state's interest in the potential life of the child can outweigh the mother's interest, her privacy rights, and abortion can be prohibited. But the court never said what they meant by the state's interest in the potential life of the child. Now, I mean, the only thing that they might have meant reasonably is something like interest in preventing declining population rates, growth rates. But of course, that's not the situation the U.S. faces. The U.S. faces an increasing population. So that can't be. So when you really look at it, there are two problems, right? One is that they didn't define that. And the other problem was that, in essence, they began by conceding the argument, not by maintaining neutrality in the question of the rights of the fetus, but by conceding the argument to the pro-choice side. In other words, that whether you say that the fetus does not have rights, or whether you say that the rights of the fetus, whether they exist or not, are not legally relevant here, then in either case, you've said the only rights that are significant when it comes to measuring the rights of the fetus against the rights of the mother are the mother's rights. And that's exactly the position that the pro-choice side had. But it's third trimester restriction. Instead, this is my view of it. Instead of being a genuine application of a limiting criteria in the state's interest, was really a concession to the pro-life people. In other words, what R.V. Wade was a futile attempt to mediate the dispute and not a rational settlement of the question. And that's why, legally, on the question of legal reasoning,
well, there's a gradation in the way that they're conceding those arguments. So by the time, you know, a fetus is in its third trimester, it genuinely resembles a human being.
It's not the resemblance that they hung that on. It's the viability of a fetus outside of the womb of the mother, which also is problematic because viability gets pushed back as medical technology progresses, gets pushed back in the process of gestation. It was viability that was the issue. Now, since the argument was, since the fetus is viable outside of the womb of the mother, the state's interest in the potential life of the child can take precedence over the mother's right to privacy. But when you think it through, it makes no sense at all unless you can define what the state's interest in the potential life of the child could possibly be. The court having set aside the question of the rights of the fetus. Say. So what you get in Roe v. Wade, if you read it, is an incoherent opinion, which masks what the court was really doing, which was trying to mediate a social dispute and failing to do.
Yes, it certainly has failed. They're still fighting over it now.
Yeah.
And the horrible thing is, you know, the pro-choice argument is really losing popularity very rapidly. This is a frightening prospect. A lot of libertarian positions are being eroded very quickly in our country.
Mm-hmm.
Even at the time that the drug reform movement is gaining momentum, and you know the gay rights movement has been gaining momentum, many of these social liberties are being just completely eaten away.
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons behind that. I mean, one is,
consider the gay rights movement. The gay rights movement, you know, in most cases, it's been decided by a Supreme Court that there is no logical, coherent, legal reason why two men or two women shouldn't be able to marry each other. And yet, in California, we saw a referendum on that, which was just based on moralism and wingnutism. And it really managed to evangelize a lot of people. And, you know, may or may not have been an actual
majority. Yeah, but I think what you're saying is you're looking at the situation from the wrong end. I think what you need to be looking at, the end that you need to be looking at it from, is the increasing plurality of the electorate that's in favor of gay marriage. I think what happened, and there's been a big debate about this in the gay marriage movement, I think what happened was that the gay marriage movement has chosen a series of battles that they were doomed to lose. And they were doomed to lose because they do not yet have a majority of the electorate. But what they have is an increasing plurality of the electorate.
Yes.
Which doesn't suggest social regression. What it does suggest is slow progress.
Well, at the same time, though, consider that this last Senate election, I hated Martha Coakley, but I voted for her. I really despise that woman. Mm-hmm. Hanging on that old man's dead for years, it was a public secret on Beacon Hill that she was hanging for it. Mm-hmm. He knew it and he hated her, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I voted for her because I thought she was the lesser of two evils. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really dreaded the thought of her winning, but Scott Brown is a very, very bad man with a very pretty face.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Scott Brown managed to really evangelize the non-college-educated white working class. These people do not constitute a majority. They do not even constitute a plurality of the people.
I don't think that's for his strength. Well, his strength was in the suburbs. Was in the affluent suburbs. I mean, that's who won that election.
Voter majority he had. I come from the suburb, but it's a working class suburb. Mm-hmm. I come from Wakefield. That was mm-hmm. actually where Scott Brown was born and grew mm-hmm. up. He went to Wakefield mm-hmm. High School. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by the numbers, the one majority he had was white, working class, non-college educated males.
He may have had that majority, but he had a majority among the affluent suburban dwellers in more affluent voters in Massachusetts. Take a look.
Well, I mean, there's affluent and there's affluent. The upper middle class tends to vote pretty reliably left. The reasons for that are tend to have more to do with social.
Not in the suburbs. Mm-mm. Not in the suburbs. Take a look. You know, take a look at the electoral results town by town. In general, what happens in Massachusetts elections, the same thing that happens in New York elections, is that the city outweighs the suburbs. And so the city goes overwhelmingly for the Democratic candidate or some kind of so-called progressive candidate, and the suburbs vote by majority against that. And it's the urban vote that carries the day. You know, with some exceptions. I mean, there are obvious exceptions, like, for example...
Well, I mean, you know, the political positions of suburbs vary a great deal, too. Arlington tends to be...
Yeah, but Arlington is not what I mean by suburb. I mean, Arlington is a progressive suburb, so it's Cambridge, if you could say Cambridge is a suburb of Boston.
Well, Cambridge is almost more like a city.
Second city. But, so what's Arlington, the suburb of Cambridge?
Sort of.
Maybe. I'm thinking of there's some other liberal suburbs even further out, like Amherst.
Well, suburbs may be affluent, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they represent an upper or an upper middle class position.
Suburbs, affluent suburbs with universities, or affluent suburbs that have been colonized. But like, for example, I'm trying to think, what's the name of the suburb near Amherst that has a huge lesbian population? Or a large lesbian population, how's the name of it? Hampton. Is it West Hampton? No, Northampton? Southampton?
Northampton?
Northampton?
Northampton is a nice place. It's a very liberal.
So they vote like Arlington.
Yeah.
But you find that those are few and far between. When you look at the towns outside of Boston, Cambridge, and the immediate, you know, Arlington is an example of a. But Arlington has been Cambridgeified. I live in Arlington. I've seen it over the years.
The strength of the right wing has never been its affluent voters, though. They might make campaign contributions, but the real strength of the right wing is in working class, which suffers from what can only really be described as a false consciousness. They think that if rich people tell them to vote a certain way, it means that they can make a take.
Yeah, I think what you're doing is you're looking at a limited phenomenon. You're looking at the talk radio audiences and things like that.
I don't listen to talk radio. I have very little knowledge of...
No, but I mean, that's who you're judging this by. I mean, for example, you're not including among workers women.
Well, no, not necessarily, but I am saying that working class males tend to have very...
And by working class males, what do you mean by working class?
Non-college educated, usually skilled laborers.
Why skilled? Unskilled laborers are not working class?
Oh, no, they are.
Janitors? Janitors vote? Did they vote overwhelmingly for Scott?
Brandon? Well, we don't know. We haven't broken it down by, you know, job.
Well, I'll answer that question for
it's
you.
It's been broken down by education level.
Unionized versus non-unionized?
Well, there you go again. That's another distinction.
I mean, I think what you're going to find is that the base for this is in non-unionized,
but the point
still downwardly mobile skilled workers.
Oh yes, that is the point I'm trying to make. Is it downwardly mobile?
But that does not outweigh the affluent voter base.
I think it outweighs them in terms of actual votes.
Okay, we're going to do a little investigation of this.